From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 67 years old and just out of prison after 50 years, a juvenile lifer wrestles with what he did as a teenager.
Every day that I live, I got to wake up and think about I took a life.
And how he hopes to keep youngsters from making the same mistakes.
I just want to stay real and sincere and hope that somebody can hear me.
Roadblocks and the quest to replace old water service lines in Flint.
I'd say our first concern, unexpected, was the quality of the city records. We knew that they were incomplete. They turned out to be about 63% accurate.
And how smartphones are changing our downtime and what we may be losing as a result. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What can America learn from Flint's water disaster? That's the question at the heart of a national water infrastructure conference that's beginning today in Flint. Among the speakers on this first day, retired Brigadier General Mike McDaniel. He directs the city's Fast Start program. And General McDaniel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. Always great to talk with you.
I remember very clearly when you and I talked just a little over a year ago, and you had agreed to direct the Fast Start program, and that goal was to replace more than 20,000 aging lead and galvanized service lines in Flint. So as we talk today, how many of those old lines have been replaced?
Well, so far we've replaced about 800 service lines in 2016, and that 2016 contract year is still ongoing. And we've dug up about 930 homes. Unfortunately, about 160 were copper to copper. So we just replaced the valve there and the shutoff valve and the junction box and then filled it back up again. I bring that up because it emphasizes the need for us to have better records of where the service lines are located and what their composition is.
Let's talk some more about those roadblocks that you've had to deal with, both expected and unexpected.
We learned a lot in 2016, our first year of doing this. I'd say our first concern, unexpected, was the quality of the city records. We knew that they were incomplete. They turned out to be about 63% accurate. The city has two sets of records, one sort of based on a plat book, which gives us the location of the shutoff valve itself, which is where we have to dig down. And those were determined by going so many feet from the nearest cross street for each home. So there's a tendency there to be wildly inaccurate as you're sort of using one of those wheels 50, 70 years ago or pacing it off trying to get the right location for the service line by finding that shutoff valve. And then secondly was the composition of the service lines themselves. Many times it would, on that little plat book, it would have a C or an L, like for copper or lead, but we'd have both there and we wouldn't know until we actually dug there. We also had a system of index cards, which the city keeps for each address with the same information on it, and those are in the process of being digitized. The city has been digitizing those since the 1990s, but any from before that period of time, we've had to go back and sort of digitize those ourselves and then sort of harmonize like an accountant between the two different sets of records to see where we have the issues. That was the first issue that we had, but it's been a major one trying to determine exactly where we should start, because we're looking for areas of the city that have the greatest density of lead service lines as the place to start. And then we couple that information with any information that we can find about the residents themselves. And of course, we're not looking for HIPAA or any sort of personal identifying information. We're looking for, based on census data from 2014, we're looking for senior citizens, we're looking for children under six, because we're told that those are the individuals are the most susceptible to lead poisoning. The second big problem we sort of learned as we went was that the lead lines were not necessarily the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario was where you had a lead line to that junction box, to the shutoff valve that I've been talking about, and then on the other side, on the homeowner's side, you have a galvanized line, because there's sort of a chemical reaction, you know, between those two metals, and the lead makes the galvanized lines corrode even faster. So inside that galvanized line is a surface area that is increased up to 10 times what it was originally, with all this rust buildup and then the lead adhering itself to that rust buildup. As well as that, water is coming through those holes, those lines, in only a trickle. that turned out to be the worst case scenario, and we had to focus then not just on where we have lead service lines, but where we have lead to galvanize lines. So if we have either of those, lead or galvanized, we're replacing them, and that became a problem because we had to identify them, and then again, that makes our subset of lines to be replaced versus the total lines in the city much greater, since we have to say we're going to replace all lead or galvanized lines going into residences in the city.
You had said last fall you were hoping that more than 1,000 service lines would be targeted in this contract spell, so you haven't quite hit that goal, but do you think the pace of replacement is going to pick up now that spring is here?
Yes, absolutely. For 2017, Cynthia, we just received bids back on our RFP, and what we envision is replacing 6,000 service lines within the city between April and end of November. We divided the city up into 10 zones of 600 homes each for this next phase, and then contractors could bid on each of those phases independently so that we would have both more contractors working and that they are required to work simultaneously. So as a result, we expect that we'll be able to do the 6,000 service lines replaced in 2017.
How long do you think it's going to take before you can say the job is done, those old, aging lead and galvanized lines are gone?
Right. So there's a couple of issues there. The first is, how do we define when we are done? There has to be at least one of those major phase lines, those major accomplishments, has to be when we replaced all the lead and galvanized lines, as you suggest. One of the reasons that we were doing this is because early on, you know, when we talked a year ago, it was very clear that there was no trust from the city residents in the system itself. By the system, I mean the water distribution system. Replacing those service lines has helped to regain the trust of the residents, as well as to assure cleaner, potable water for the residents to use. I can't say that that will be the end of all the issues, because some of it has to be where the residents trust the system to give them clean, potable water. And there may be that more is needed, but I will say that I think this will take care of a huge amount of the problem. This is the one place where we have found that there is lead, and the lead is contributing to the quality of the water in the individual homes. Every expert and scientist, whether it's from a university, whether it's from other outside entities, whether it's from state or federal government, agrees that if we replace the lead and galvanized service lines, we will greatly increase the quality of the water. And that's what we're striving to do. One of the issues, though, as you suggest, is sometimes it doesn't feel like it's really a fast start when we say it's going to take another 3 years to replace all the service lines. We will have done, by the time we're done with this phase, around 825 service lines, and then we're going to start right in with the 6,000. If we do that for 3 years and we replace, we think, around 19,000 lines, we will have addressed the problem. That does take us 3 years, and that may not seem fast, but in comparison with replacements by other cities such as Lansing, they did not have a crisis, of course, but they had an orderly program for changing out their service lines. It took them over 10 years to do 14,000 lines. So if we accomplish the replacement of 19,000 service lines in 3 more years or 4 years total, that will be a very ambitious program, but we think it's what's needed.
General, at the same time, do you feel like you're kind of right in the middle of the logistics of what it's going to take to get those lines out of the ground and the frustration of the people in Flint who wonder if they will ever be able to trust their water?
Yes, no question. There's a tension there at all times between realizing we have to depend upon the science, wait for the orthophosphate lead coating to work in circumstances where you don't have a lead or a galvanized pipe, and replace the ones that you do, to also either upgrade or restructure other parts of the water system and explain to the residents why, you know, it takes 4 or 5 years and millions of dollars to achieve a problem which has been slowly continuing, and that the infrastructure has been slowly crumbling for as many as 80 years. We have some pipes in distribution and transmission pipes that are 80 years old. That's a little bit longer than you want your cast iron pipes to get. But the city of Flint is not at a place yet where it can have a maintenance schedule and just replace those as more economically sound cities where they've got a program in place to do that maintenance on a regular basis based upon what they know they can receive from federal funding. So we're not there yet. And that's a hard lesson for these citizens. because there is so much that we have to do, and they've already suffered so much. They've been living in fear. They've been living in doubt since 2015, at least, but it is not fixed yet, and it's going to take at least 3 or 4 years to do so.
And is the money there to get you across the finish line, or will Flint have to keep going back and trying to shake money out of somebody to get this done?
The money's not there in the sense that we do not have sufficient money yet committed from state and federal governments to do so. We have enough money to do 2017. We have enough money to do most of 2018, but we don't have enough to complete 2018 or 2019 for service line replacements. We certainly have commitments from the governor and his staff that they will continue to work with us, and they have been doing that, but we don't yet have a commitment for the funds, no.
As you speak to the Water Infrastructure Conference today, what should other regions of the country learn from what you're doing in Flint?
A number of things. First, I hope with my remarks they're going to learn from the problems that we had so that they assure that they've got an active maintenance program, that they're looking at all the city-owned critical infrastructure, and whether it's, you know, bridges or pipelines or transmission systems, and saying we have to maintain this now because it costs way too much to get it right side up again when it collapses. And then secondly, I hope that they're thinking about ways in which they can sort of build resiliency into their system. One of the things that we have found is that the many different utilities are not placed where they should be placed, you know, when they do them in the ground. You know, we have sewer and water lines that are on top of each other. We have gas and electrical lines that are too close to the other lines. It's like you've got to have that planning on the front end and that effective regulation of any sort of repairs that are done to systems, and keeping those records is just so important. It's that little stuff that city government needs to do to stave off these sort of problems. And then I think the other thing is talking about, what do you need to do to assure that this doesn't happen? You know, it's sort of a comparison of a city like Lansing, perhaps, where the Board of Water and Light had a program to replace this on a regular basis and were able to do so out of internal funds, out of Hyde, whereas the city of Flint did not have a program in place. And when everything collapsed, we had to seek the funds from the state and federal governments. So I think there are broad issues in terms of planning, in terms of response, and then in terms of infrastructure resiliency that I hope that other cities take away from this.
Retired Brigadier General Michael McDaniel, who directs Flint's Fast Start program, speaking on this first day of the National Water Infrastructure Conference in Flint. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you find yourself having to wait, maybe in a parking lot, maybe in a line for coffee, what's the very first thing you do? U of M Institute for Social Research scientist Daniel Kruger got to wondering about that question, and he turned it into an observational study. His results seem to prove we are not able to just be, not when there's a smartphone that we can whip out. Daniel, good to have you with us.
Hello. Good to be with you again.
What pointed you toward studying just how we're filling our downtime?
Well, it goes back several years. I gave an invited talk at a small college in Ohio. And at that time, they didn't have any cell phone towers. So when I was walking around campus, it was a very different experience because people were very social. They were looking at each other in the eyes, smiling and talking to each other spontaneously. And for me, this was kind of like a step back into a utopian time past. So it made me really wonder about this intersection of this virtual space and social space. So we decided to take a look at this to just see what happens when people are in live space, how often are they using their phones?
So what kind of situations did you observe?
So these are people who are waiting for something to happen, whether it's waiting for a class to start, waiting for a line for coffee, waiting for the bus. So basically downtime. You know, times that we would have in the past considered downtime where we're expecting something to happen, we're waiting for something to happen, but we have the opportunity to fill our time in some way. So we decided to see, well, how many people would actually converse with those around them versus how many people would actually go on their cell phones and reach out to their virtual world, whether they're going to be texting people actively or just going on Facebook.
What'd you find?
Well, we found that most people did go on their phones. If people are in a live conversation, they're less likely to. But those people who went on their phones did it really quickly. So most of them did it within the first 10 seconds. and 80% of people did it within the first 20 seconds.
We can't bear to just be.
Right. You know, so any opportunity where we would normally, be there waiting for something to happen is a potential opportunity to, you know, get into our virtual world.
Fall into Facebook, start tweeting, check Instagram, start texting, that virtual world. And, you know, I'm thinking of a few years back, and it was before I had an iPhone that I could take out and fall into my virtual world. I was in a long line at a post office, and an elderly gentleman was next to me in line. And somehow we got to talking, and here I discovered he had been a prisoner of war in World War II. This incredible story that we were able to kind of unpack in the time we were waiting in line. So we're losing moments like that.
Right, yeah. The next time you go out to a coffee shop or something, just look to see how many people are on their phones when they're waiting in line. And this is something, you know, that does raise some concern. Are people going to be so sucked into their virtual worlds that they're not socializing with those people who are around them? You know, potential opportunities to meet people and hear, you know, about their lives and really interesting stories, or even just to have social interactions with other people in their environment.
And I'm curious whether you found any difference between men and women.
Well, we did predict a difference, and we predicted that women would be more likely to use their phones because they tend to be more conversational, more social than men, and that was the case. So women were more likely to use their phones than men, but both men and women took the same amount of time to use them. So it wasn't like women used them quicker, it's just that they were more likely to use them. And also people who were in a live conversation were less likely to use their phones than those who wouldn't, but still a substantial proportion, you know, like about 32% of people still use their phones when they're in conversation, and 70% did when they weren't.
So what worries does all of this create in your mind?
Well, you know, we want to make sure that people are getting the benefits of this technology, but we don't want it to detract from or interfere with our real life socialization. Mm-hmm. So one of the challenges we have is that, you know, people who are growing up with this technology, you know, it's almost, you could almost see it as like a crutch where this is how they socialize. But what happens when they actually have to talk to a stranger in real life social space? You know, are they going to be able to carry on, appropriate social interactions? You know, are they going to be, you know, limited just to the friends that they have in their virtual social network?
The folks that they can shoot texts to or that they can Snapchat with or send Instagram photos with, but you're saying looking eye to eye could pose a problem?
Right, yeah, and that actually poses, you know, even a social challenge in the sense that people could become increasingly isolated and not know the people around them, you know, not even know the people in their own community, their neighbors, the people who, you know, share a social space with them. Because each person is surrounded by their own little social bubble.
And this is one of the first studies, am I correct, to explore how we use our phones while we're waiting?
Right, because most research that's done on cell phones is through surveys where people are self-reporting their activities. There are some people who can use an app or get the data from the phones itself about, you know, how often people are using it, how many minutes a day. But you really have to do an observational study to see how people are using it in social space.
As you say, it seems quaint. It wasn't that long ago when we weren't standing there thumbing through a screen.
Yeah, I think it would be difficult for most people today to carry on with their daily lives, you know, without phones, without the internet and such. And it's almost unimaginable. How did people work? How did people arrange things, you know, 40, 50 years ago? So our world has changed considerably. And there are people who are living in, you know, so-called dark areas, you know, near radio telescopes where cell phones interfere with the signal. There's people who choose to live in those environments where, you know, cell phones just don't work. But I think for most people, that is maybe much of a stretch. So, you know, trying to find a good balance. So being able to use your phone, being able to use the internet for those purposes that it's good for, but at the same time, carve out some time for real life interactions, for some social space, you know, for meeting and talking to strangers so that we don't lose the human connection.
Good advice, Daniel Kruger, scientist with the U of M Institute for Social Research. His study is published in the Journal of Technology in Behavioral Science, and you've certainly given me something to think about, and I am going to tell myself I'm going to keep that thing in my purse and put eyes up and look around at the people around me.
Thanks. Excellent.
Thanks so much for being with us.
It's good to see you again.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name is Alex Petrosky. He's 11 years old. His best friend is the stray dog that he adopted and named after his hero, astronomer Carl Sagan. Together, they set out on a road trip that's about rockets, about recordings made for intelligent life beyond this world, and about finding your place in this world. Alex is a central character in a newly released young adult novel, See You in the Cosmos, written by my guest, Jack Cheng. With us now, Jack, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Describe your young hero, Alex. What kind of kid is he?
I think he's a kid who is very he's very optimistic, and he has this outlook on life where he kind of just assumes the very best of people, no matter sort of how maybe crazy and chaotic his situations and environment around him is. He just kind of goes in assuming the best.
And the way that we learn Alex's story is very, very unique, because it's recordings this little boy is making on an iPod. So when intelligent beings who are millions of light years away from Earth find it, they'll know what Earth and its people are like. Where did you get this idea of framing Alex's story this way?
Yeah, so the idea first came to me when I was actually at home here in Michigan at my parents' house, and I saw on my brother's shelf a copy of Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot, and I remembered an episode of the radio show Radiolab that I had listened to, where Carl Sagan's widow, Andruian, was talking about the way the two of them worked together to gather sounds for the Voyager Golden Record. And so it sort of like was inspired by radio.
And just a refresher course for everybody, that was back in 77, was it, when Voyager was heading off and they made the Golden Record?
Right, right. And the idea was to, you know, to put on it all these sounds and music and even they even encoded images onto it, so that if extraterrestrial beings outside our solar system were to come across this Golden Record, they would have a sense of what Earth was like.
And this bright little boy, so as we're learning his story, it's him telling the extraterrestrials that we'll someday find that golden iPod.
Right, right. He kind of like, he finds out or he knows about what his hero Carl Sagan did. And he's sort of like, yeah, you know, I could do that. And I could do that on this iPod that I got.
This little boy is all about rockets and Carl Sagan and what is out there in space. And he is taking himself to the Southwest High Altitude Rocket Festival, SHARF. He wants to compete by launching a rocket that he has built himself. And I'm wondering if you'd read us an excerpt from See You in the Cosmos. This is kind of early on, right, when Alex is kind of introducing himself to his extraterrestrial audience?
Yeah, yeah, this is very early on. This is actually the night before he leaves for SHARF. So he's sort of a little awake with anticipation. What do you guys do when you can't fall asleep? Maybe you don't need sleep at all. Maybe you're just awake all the time because your planet spins so slowly that you're always facing the sun. It's always day. Or maybe you guys do the opposite. You pretty much sleep whenever you're not eating, like koalas or Carl Sagan. He also, Alex has a dog named after his hero. He just curls into a donut on the bed or sofa or my lap, and he starts falling asleep, easy. Are you sleeping right now? I guess not, because how would you be listening to this if you were sleeping? I guess that means we're both awake. I finished packing last night, and today I spent the whole day making food for my mom when I'm gone. My mom knows how to cook, and she's a great cook. But I've been making food for us so much this year that I'd feel bad if I didn't do something. Plus, she was having another one of her quiet days where she stays in bed and stares at the little bumps on the ceiling. I think she likes counting them. I brought water to her room and I told her, I made you food for the next 3 days when I'm at SHARF. All you have to do is take out the Gladware from the refrigerator and heat it up in the microwave, and I love you. I thought I'd be really tired after making all that food, but I wasn't. I tried listening to Beethoven and Chuck Berry and watching my Blu-ray of Contact, but they only made me more awake. I tried sleeping in Ronnie's bed, too. And Ronnie is Alex's older brother. I keep everything on his side of our room exactly how it was when he moved out. So that way, when he comes home to visit, he'll see all his sexy lady posters on the wall and his sports trophies on the shelf, and he'll feel like he never left. Sometimes I sleep in his bed, though, because maybe if you sleep where another person sleeps and do what that person does, then eventually you'll start turning into that person. You'll think like they think and remember what they remember, and after a while, you'll have big muscles and make a lot of money to buy groceries for your mom.
That's writer Jack Chang reading from his new young adult novel, See You in the Cosmos. And we're certainly getting clues about Alex Petrosky's life at home, that he's kind of raising himself.
Yeah, yeah. His father died when he was really young. And, you know, as you might be able to tell from that excerpt, that there are some things happening with his mother that maybe he isn't fully conscious of. And he also has an older brother that lives in a different state.
And Alex does something that I think many kids dream of but would never dare actually do. Strikes out on his own with his dog Carl Sagan at his side on this road trip heading off to this rocket festival. But besides going to Scharf, this rocket festival, what is this child really searching for on his road trip?
I think he's trying to find these answers about his family. His brother Ronnie is very sort of reluctant to talk about their father. And so Alex has this father that he never knew, and he's really trying to understand his role in sort of the shaping of his family. And I think Alex is asking all these questions about, you know, what is family and like what does it mean to be at home? I think he's also just trying to really make this deeper connection to like his family and to just like other people. And I think he's sort of using and talking to the aliens as a way of even just like talking things out himself.
You were born in Shanghai and you came to Detroit as an immigrant at a very, very young age, around five?
Yes, that's correct.
How much of that experience, Jack, do you think informed the story that you created around Alex?
When I was writing the book, I wasn't thinking much about that. But I think one of the wonderful things about writing fiction is that sort of it surfaces all these very deep subconscious for me, too, things. And one of the things I actually remembered when I finished the book was that I originally wrote it. The setting of the book was based on this road trip that I took myself in the American Southwest in the summer of 2013. And one of the motivations for that trip was so that at the very end of it, I could repeat this Greyhound bus ride that my father had taken. He came about 6 months before my mom and I did. He flew from Shanghai to California to visit some friends, and then he took a Greyhound bus ride from LA to Detroit. That was like 2.5 days. And so I think I remembered that like one of my reasons for doing that trip was so at the very end I could do that. And in hindsight, I think it was also me asking these same questions about like my family and about sort of how I came to be where I am here in not only the United States and not only in Michigan, but here at this place in my life.
This little boy traveling on his own meets strangers, and he does discover kindness. What do you hope your young readers learn from that part of Alex's story?
What I hope they learn is that I think there's a lot to going into a situation without this sort of mindset that, you know, there are good guys and bad guys. And I think, like, Alex has this kind of openness about him, this, like, lack of judgment on other people and the things other people do. And I think because of that, because of this attitude that he has, he's more able to kind of like listen and engage. And I think that's what attracts all these, more adult and older helpers in his life, is because you can go into something with a positive attitude and it sort of becomes this like self-fulfilling prophecy.
He could have been a tough, cynical kid, but you gave him an old soul and a very, very kind heart.
Thank you.
Jack Cheng's new young adult novel is See You in the Cosmos. And Jack will be in conversation with author Holly Goldberg Sloan this coming Thursday, March 9th. It's at 7 p.m. at Nicholas Books in Ann Arbor. So it should be a great conversation. Jack, thank you so much for sharing your book with us, See You in the Cosmos.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That image we see in old movies of the police officer walking the beat, that may be one of the best ways for police and public safety officers to build closer ties with the people they serve and protect. A recent study by the Police Foundation examines this tradition of foot patrols and how it's working in four communities, including Kalamazoo. With us now is Kalamazoo's Public Safety Chief, Jeff Hadley. Chief, that report from the Police Foundation singles out your department as taking a particularly innovative approach to build trust and enhance its relationship with the community. Pretty remarkable to think that back in March 2014, you launched this by having officers knock on every single door in the city.
Yes. I mean, it was ambitious, obviously. I mean, there's a lot of, probably about 15,000 homes in our community. Now, I will qualify that by saying, you know, not everybody answered the door or were home at the time we knocked on the door, but we figured we'd reach a good number of our citizens. And it took us about 15 months, so it wasn't we didn't get it done in the calendar year, but we did take about 15 months to cover those bases, and it was extremely eye-opening for our officers and for our community.
How so?
You know, for the community, they'd never seen this before, right? At times, we got either an email or sometimes even a phone call. Is this for real? Are they really police officers? Because they're not used to having just an officer knock on their door and ask them, hey, how are we doing and what can we do better? You know, so they really realize there's so many good people out here in our community, even in the most challenged neighborhoods, that support them, that need them, that want them. And, you know, that really came through in their discussions with the citizens during those contacts.
And then how have you taken that and incorporated that into the policing that you're doing today in Kalamazoo?
Well, I think you have to make that part of, it's not a program, right? Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be, although this was an initiative, we had a goal to reach every door, but it really needs to be part of the everyday toolbox for any officer in any community. So it should become natural to them, right? So I'm going to get in my squad car, I'm going to go to my district, I'm going to answer my calls for service because that's in part what we do. But in my free time, when I have the downtime to be able to do so, I'm going to get out of my car, I'm going to connect with people. And we want that to be just part of the thinking. You know, so it should be more natural or more organic, And so that's our goal. And so, I mean, you got to be intentional about it, and you got to have that kind of organizational pressure to lay out the expectations relative to that. But I would hope over time, as it evolves, and the officers and the community see the value in that, that it is what they do. And so we don't have to do a news release that, hey, we're doing this, or a study needs to be done that we're doing foot patrols. It's just part of what they do. No different than gas in their car, no different than taking a barking dog complaint. They're going to get out of the car. They're going to connect with their community when time allows, when weather allows. And we hope that's how it roots into the organization. And then it outlasts me. It outlasts when people retire. It just comes part of the DNA of the organization.
Jeff, can you give us some examples of things that perhaps your officers have been able to do as they're on foot in the neighborhoods that would probably not have happened if they'd been in cars?
Yeah, well, so one thing that sticks out to me is, so one of our officers, one of our sergeants actually was out engaging in the foot patrols and canvassing in the neighborhood. And so he'd been out for about an hour, and a citizen comes up to him, shakes his hand and says, really appreciate you being out here. And the citizen walks away. Well, what he did is in his hand, he had a note. And in that note to the officer was some information on a shooting that had occurred in the previous days and the name of a suspect who happened to be the actual person that did that shooting. So I think that this officer realized the value, one of the values of this is he got to go out and look for a bad guy, which is why a lot of us obviously get into this line of work. So I think that really was a kind of a watershed moment for that officer who may have been, you know, well, does this have any value? Does this work? But it does, because the person trusted you enough to come up, shake your hand, give you some information, and then you got to go out and look for that person that had committed that crime in the previous couple of days. So I think that's one of the things that is highlighted in my mind.
It seems that for your officers and for the community, each is putting a face on the other.
Absolutely. We have to humanize each other. And you can't do that on Facebook. You can't do that in a car. You have to do it, you know, connecting with people in a real way. And it has to be authentic and genuine. And people will see that coming through the more you do it. That's what connects people and community together, is their trust in you, their belief in you, and their support of you. And this is just one way to do that from a grassroots organizational perspective.
When you think of that image that I cited at the top of this interview that we see in the movies of the officer walking the beat, and everybody knew who that officer was and that officer knew the neighborhood, kind of is everything old is new again.
You're absolutely right. Making human contact and relating to people has never changed in thousands of years.
Jeff Hadley is the chief of the Kalamazoo Department of Public Safety. Chief, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
There are hundreds of inmates in Michigan who were under age 18 when they received mandatory sentences of life without parole. Two landmark rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court have made it clear those mandatory life without parole terms for juveniles are unconstitutional. To date, five of these juvenile lifers have been released from Michigan prisons. One of them is 67-year-old John Hall. He was convicted in a 1967 fatal beating that happened in a Detroit alley. On February 2nd, John Hall became a free man after spending some 50 years in prison. Accompanied by his attorney, Valerie Newman, of the Michigan State Appellate Defender Office, John Hall spoke with me about his decades in prison. Here's what he told us on Monday stateside.
I had to reinvent myself. I didn't have nobody to look up to when I come to prison, a little kid, because I didn't want to be like them.
We now continue my conversation with John Hall.
Number one, God. Number two, that lady, Miss Valerie Newman, sitting right there. She asked me the tough questions, and I told them to her. And I think what really stuck out, I can't say because I can't speak for her. I think what really stood out was when I told her how remorseful I am for my crime and that I got to wake up every day, that every day that I live, I got to wake up and think about I took a life. Every day, the man, wife, Mr. Hoffman, wife, she forgave me. Her and my mother used to come to court every day. She was there when I got the life sentence. She forgave me. But that woman can't never forget, just like me. This is going to be inside of me for the rest of my life. And I hope that in some way, that somebody will hear me and I can save a life.
John, there are a lot of kids right now that are like you were when you were 16, 17. What would you say to 16-year-old John if you could talk to him right now?
That in life, you have to make decisions. And it's best not to make rash decisions. Think about what you gonna do or say before they come out your mouth or you act on them. Because there's that fork in the road where you have to make a choice. Do I do what I like doing or do I do what's best for me? And the best thing for them to do is to do what's best for them. Don't follow the crowd. Don't try to fit in and get in. Try to be an individual. And if you got a role model, let it be somebody positive, not somebody out there on the streets selling dope, robbing people, breaking in houses, because that only lead to one thing. Two, death or prison. But you can change your life. You can change it. Can't nobody else change it for you. But you can, if you look down inside and stand on principles, if you stand on principles and got some kind of integrity, you can do it. It ain't gonna be easy. Guys gonna be smoking around you, getting high. You used to doing it. The temptation gonna be there, but you gotta fight it. You gotta fight it. You got to do the best thing for your future. Don't think about the here and now. I done did 50 years in penitentiary. And I hope you don't do 50 years in penitentiary. I hope your future is a lot better and brighter than that. Because a lot of things could have happened positive for my future had I not been in prison in 50 years. Now, if I had a son, I would tell him this here. Stand on your own. Don't let nobody lead you. Be your own leader.
You've got this new chapter now.
Yeah.
What do you want to do with this time you have?
What I'm doing now. Because the time that I got left on this planet, this is what I want to do. I ain't good at it, but I'm sincere. I don't want to get no polish or nothing. I just want to stay real and sincere and hope that somebody can hear me and listen to what I'm saying, because a lot of people hear you, but they don't listen. That they can listen to what I'm saying, and it might can start a chain reaction. Well, man, that old man right. And you hear that? That old man right. Chain reaction.
Plant a seed.
Right, plant a seed. I couldn't have said no better.
You know, that sentence you got, John, it doesn't happen unless, and as you say, it's a crime that you're living with every day of your life.
Yeah.
And people who are out there who are going to say, look, you got convicted because you were involved in a crime where someone was killed and that you shouldn't be released. What do you say to those people?
I thought about that, too, because at first I didn't want the publicity. And I was kind of upset that it was in the paper. But I done seen a lot of good come from that. But to answer your question is, I say the same thing that was said in the Bible. It might be to a lesser degree than what I did. But let ye who have not sinned cast the first stone. We all make mistakes. Some is more severe than others. But Jesus said, forgive your brother. Forgive him. Don't fake like you forgiving him. Forgive him. Because if all of us was condemned for our sins, I don't think I even need to say no more about that.
You talked about forgiveness.
Have
you forgiven yourself?
No. No. Because I feel like God didn't let me live these 50 years just to come out here like the rest of these guys do and forget where they came from. I feel that forgiveness should be within the individual. If he want to forgive you, he can. If he don't, he can't. You got to go on with your life. And the reason I haven't forgiven myself is for the reason I just said. I got a lot of work to do. I got to live with this the rest of my life. I'm a very emotional person, as you can see. And sometimes I be alone, and I think about what I took from that woman, his wife, his community, everything. I can live with myself, but I can't forgive myself. I think that's the best way to say it. I can live with myself, but I can't never forgive because I can't never forget. I took the most precious thing that we have from another human being. Now, like I said, I don't blame it on my immaturity. I didn't want to kill him. I didn't try to kill him. But it happened. And I take responsibility for it, like I told that judge when he sentenced me. But I guess the next question would be, well, if you can't forgive yourself, why should others forgive you? Like I said, it's their choice. But I'm the one that did it. I know I'm not the same person no more. And everybody that know me know I ain't that person no more. Another thing was, I didn't understand the finality of life. I didn't know it meant forever. And it wasn't like I went to kill him, because wasn't no weapons involved. And it was struggling.
And you were a kid.
I was a kid.
You were a kid. But you have a chance now.
Yeah, hopefully.
You've got things you want to do. It sounds like, in a sense, I don't know if atonement is the right word, but you want to do some good.
Right.
This is your chance.
Yeah, because you asked me a question ago, what would I say to the youngsters out there? And that's what I would say, my way of atoning and showing that God had a plan for me. I could have come out of prison and just been bewildered. But I'm sitting here because that's part of the plan. Because God knows that in my heart, I would never, ever even think about doing nothing like that no more. And this voice, it's not the most articulate voice you're going to hear. It's not going to be smooth or none of that. But it's raw and from my heart. That's what I want to do. I want people to see that I'm just an everyday guy that's trying to say, walk right, live right, talk right. That's all I'm trying to say. If it wasn't God's plan, I wouldn't be sitting here. And God said to forgive. So I'm working on it.
John Hall, thank you for sharing your story with us and enlightening people. And we wish you well as you build this new life.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate that.